Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 20th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Well, folks, we're in the midst of an incredible battle led by LaRouche PAC and members, the leaders of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee. This battle is taking place in Washington, D.C., but it's also taking place in every congressional district throughout the country. It's a battle that will determine whether or not the Congress has the guts and the intelligence to defend the American system. And that test case is the case of passing Glass-Steagall. Now, many of you know what Glass-Steagall is. For those of you who might just be coming to the show, I'll briefly summarize it. It's a bill which would stop the bailouts, stop the bail-ins, and write off the unpayable hundreds of trillions of dollars of debt being held on the books of banks as a result of the wild speculation by the swindlers of the large banks, the so-called too-big-to-fail banks. Glass-Steagall would say if you're going to be a commercial bank, you have to get rid of the side of your banking that includes the speculative debt. If you want to be an investment bank, you can keep it, but it's going to be written down. Now, by passing Glass-Steagall, we could then move to policies such as a credit system through a national banking arrangement, which would establish credit to the banks for production. And that's what the whole fight is about. So this is not really a battle over a bill, although passing Glass-Steagall, which is H.R. 129, and then there are two Glass-Steagall bills in the Senate, passing Glass-Steagall is the starting point. But it's actually a fight over a concept of government and what government should do. And in fact, it's a battle over a concept of man. Those who are opposing Glass-Steagall are the people in the so-called too-big-to-fail banks, people in hedge funds and the shadow banking system, swaps and derivatives dealers. You know, it's really the scum of the scum in this country, the people who think they can swindle their clients to make a buck. But that they're only the lower level of the opposition. The higher level is the British Empire, the City of London-centered banks, who are committed not just to a conception of banking, but committed to deprive governments of sovereignty. In other words, to take away from governments their ability to defend their population. And once that's taken away, they will kill and kill and kill because their goal, the goal of this empire, is to reduce the population of the world from 7 billion to 1 billion. And we already see this coming into play in what's happening in Detroit, what's already happened in Greece and Portugal and elsewhere around the world. And those fighting for Glass-Steagall are those who are defending the American Revolution, defending the U.S. Constitution, and the view of man, the concept of man that's behind the Constitution, which is, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, all men who are endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's what the fight is. It's nothing less than that. So we're going to be discussing today with two of the leaders of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee who have been in Washington, D.C. this last week and will be there for the next week and who knows, maybe the week after that. As long as Congress is in session and there's a fight on this, I think the Policy Committee can be counted on to be there to lead. But their leadership and their ability to win is going to be dependent on what you do, what you, the listener, do to back up this fight. So joining me today are two people who were candidates in the last election cycle, Keisha Rogers, who won the Democratic nomination twice in the 22nd District of Texas, where Glass-Steagall was a central part of her campaign, along with impeaching Obama, and Dave Christie, who ran for Congress in the Seattle area and Washington and forced the passage throughout the state of resolutions supporting Glass-Steagall. The senator from Washington State, Maria Cantwell, is one of the people who reintroduced a Glass-Steagall bill in the Senate. As I said, the two of them were in Washington this week leading the fight. So, Dave and Keisha, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley.
Hi. Thank you, Harley.
Keisha, let's begin with you because you have quite a bit of authority as a two-time Democratic nominee, and the authority is not because of the party, but because you ran against the party, because the Democratic Party in your district was defending the president. You were calling for the president's impeachment, and at the same time for Glass-Steagall and a gearing up of NASA as part of the policy committee's insistence that once we get Glass-Steagall, we go to credit policy and infrastructure development. So let me just ask you, when I characterize this as a battle, give people a sense of the kind of battles that you had in the meetings, because I believe there were somewhere close to 40, 50 meetings with congressional offices.
That's right.
But these are real battles, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, what people have to understand is, I'll just say, as Mr. LaRouche made clear on the webcast he had last night, what we're in the middle of is a fight of life or death for the nation and for the world and for civilization for some time to come, that the enemies of humanity, of mankind, do not want to see Glass-Steagall pass. They will put everything that they have into this fight to destroy the mobilization and the passage of Glass-Steagall. Now, what we found, and that's exactly what we found in Washington, D.C., and going to these congressional offices, because as we were there this week, we were able to really smoke out the enemy, that they are not in any way hiding what their intentions are and what they're doing. And as we were on the ground in full force with the entire policy committee going into these offices, as well as our representatives or constituents and delegations from states across the country, we had a strong force of delegations from several states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, Virginia, just to name a few. And what we did in going into these offices and making it clear that we're not going to allow the Congress members to capitulate and to bow down to the Wall Street interests while people are losing their farms, are losing their ability to produce food, agriculture, industries, and that what we got in these offices was in many cases, one, a complete recognition that there is a complete capitulation to Wall Street and continuing to defend the interests of Wall Street. And a lot of this came from the Financial Services Committee offices, where, you know, they tried to make the statistical arguments that it's okay to gamble with people's money, it's okay to hedge bets, it's okay to have derivatives, and that this is just our belief and our style, that, you know, our understanding of what has to be done, and to say the Glass-Steagall wouldn't work. But go ahead.
Let me just ask you, how much do you think, from your personal experience there this week, of the opposition is due to corruption, to stupidity, to cowardice? I mean, do you find all three in some of these offices?
All three. I mean, I can tell you that we went into particular offices, and what we unleashed it, and what was discovered is that Congress members are just front men. They're just sort of out there as the face. But the people really running the office are Wall Street interests. I mean, what you would find is that people in these offices who were chiefs of staffs, who were legislative directors, were people who had been working on Wall Street, working with J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, and then got put into a congressional office as the chief of staff of that office. And you go and you listen to these Congress members speaking, and you're saying, this Congress member can hardly formulate a sentence, and why is he in office? And then you go to their office, and you have a meeting with their staffer, and the staffer is telling you that, you know, basically, we run the show here. You guys aren't going to get Glass-Steagall through. So that's for people to understand. When we say we're up against an enemy and this is a battle, this is serious. And that's why we're going to escalate, and why we're in full force, and we're going to show the enemy that they're not going to win this one.
Now, Dave, let me ask you on the same topic. To what extent did you find that even though there had been previous visits from representatives of the banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and others, to what extent were you aware that the Congress was under some pressure to meet with us because of activity of the constituents?
Well, I think obviously the numbers of meetings that we actually had is a testimony to that. And I know that there's plans for contacting our base and so forth across the nation now for these next 2 weeks to get meetings with offices that we've never met with, places where we have maybe more dissipated activity, but we have strong activists all across the nation, so we're going to be activating people to be setting up meetings across, you know, from some of the areas that we don't get to, particularly some of the areas that are actually have been devastated by the collapse of the physical economy, which of course is really all parts of the nations, but you know, you get into some of these rural areas and the devastation is very intense. There was just a report put out by the American Medical Association which shows that some of the poorer counties, which, you know, some of the rural counties and so forth, have a close to 10-year less life expectancy. And I think these kind of reports, if you really let it sink in, this is what LaRouche and what we've been saying on the question of this is a policy to kill. So, but I do think the pressure that comes from the constituents is absolutely crucial. I will say this on the, you have an obvious factor of corruption, which is the straight, we're walking in, we're a top bank, we're going to write you a check, you're going to listen to us. But I think the other level of way that the operation is controlled in D.C. is through a kind of social control. And the way that it works is many of these congressmen feel intimidated on these banking questions, and they defer to either other congressmen or staffers or so on who are directly part of what has been described as this revolving door policy, where you'll have staffers or congressmen or chiefs of staff, on Capitol Hill for a few years, over to J.P. Morgan Chase for a few years, back to Capitol Hill, over to Goldman Sachs, this kind of back and forth. And what is the big thing that we are combating is to go in there with the power of ideas and to demolish these lines, which is really how Congress is run. It's run by some sophisticated lines, or sophistical, I guess I should say, lines, that have no basis in reality, and we come in armed with truth, and that's how, you know, to combat this in an intellectual fashion, but even more than simply intellectually, it's a moral fight that we're waging with these people. So I think that factor of social control of people who say, "Oh, I can't deal with this," and we break it down for them and give them the ideas that are actually rooted in the solution.
Well, Dave, was there recognition in the offices where you had meetings of the Captor bill in the House and the Harkin bill and then the Elizabeth Warren bill in the Senate? Were people aware that these bills had been introduced?
Actually, Harley, I was somewhat shocked to find out that in the course of organizing, we would see congressmen who were actually on the Captor bill who had no idea that there existed both the Harkin bill and the Cantwell, Angus King, Elizabeth Warren, McCain bill. And I just found that stunning. And so, you know, there's a way where they really do operate within a cloud, and that's an intentional hazy atmosphere created by Wall Street, created by the media to keep these people in the dark on this. And so our presence was absolutely crucial in more ways than just simply the meetings. We also had a banner throughout the course of the week That banner is actually at the intersection where every one of the congressmen going over for a vote in the House has to walk by us. And it had a very, on the one hand, you know, people saying, well, you're all over the place. I just can't walk anywhere without running into you. And other people saying, look, I know about Glass-Steagall. Other congressmen saying, I know about Glass-Steagall because of your work, of you being out here day after day over these, you know, over this last year. So, but yeah, it is amazing that some of these, they don't even know what's going on amongst themselves because of the way that they're somewhat kept in a haze.
Well, of course, they're all very well aware of the George Zimmerman verdict. They're very well aware of abortion fights, of the immigration fight, because that's really the confetti and the haze that's thrown up as a way of distracting people from the fact that they're pretty soon they're not going to be able to eat, they're losing their homes, they've already lost jobs. So this is why our deployment there and your deployment in your district, making calls, getting, you know, one of the things our listeners can do is if you find this program interesting, get all your friends to listen to it. It's going to be archived on LaRouchePub.com. The LaRouche Show for today, get people to listen to it. Just to remind people, this is the LaRouche Show. You're listening to a discussion on the scene battle being run by the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee, directed by Lyndon LaRouche personally, to get a Glass-Steagall bill through the House and Senate within the next couple of weeks. I'm talking with former candidates for Congress, Dave Christie and Keisha Rogers, Dave from the Seattle, Washington area, Keisha from Houston, Texas. Keisha, let me go back to you because I think that, you know, it's extremely important that some of the things that we take for granted be discussed so that our listeners have a sense of this. But one of the things that I know we discovered is that there were certain things that hit harder than others. Talking about Glass-Steagall, people tend to think of this as a banking bill, financial legislation. But one of the things you and others determined in discussing with LaRouche, that it's really important that we present the whole context, including the collapse of the physical economy and the real suffering that's being imposed on people as a result of this collapse. Give us some sense of how that worked when you were meeting with these offices.
I think the most important thing is to, as we were meeting with the office, the unique role that we represented was that we represented the idea of a unified nation. And what that means, we let people know, look, we don't care about your partisan bickering. Don't tell us that the Republicans are never going to let this happen. You know, don't say the Democrats have this problem. What Glass-Steagall is, as a principle, is going to do as the first step to unifying this nation, this could be the thing that could bring the Congress together in a way that's never brought the Congress together before. And the biggest enemy to Glass-Steagall and what it represents is not Republicans versus Democrats, but it's the oligarchy, the financial institutions that want to keep the Congress divided so they can continue to push the policies that are murdering the population. And I think what was important is when we had a show of force where we would have two policy committee members, sometimes three policy committee members going into a meeting at a time and say, we represent the voice of the nation. You know, we're from Texas, Massachusetts, from Seattle, Washington, and we have people all over the country. And I think that the most important thing, and this is something that Mr. LaRouche is saying, people have to really get a grasp of, that Glass-Steagall principle means a return to everything that our U.S. Constitution represented under the foundation of Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, that principle comes before party. Party has been the bane and the rot of the nation. And the reason why we're in this mess is because of the political partisan bickering that has been going on between people. That's intentional. Because the intention is never to allow Glass-Steagall to come through, never especially to allow the principles in which Glass-Steagall represents in terms of a total
development of a new renaissance, a reorganizing your entire economy back to physical economic production, making sure your people can eat, making sure you have industry and infrastructure. That's what Wall Street doesn't want to happen. And that's what people were responding to. Go ahead.
On that point, I know that you had some letters, and the committee as a whole had some letters from people talking about the suffering going on as a result of these policies. And one of the things that we know is that the congressmen themselves rarely get into their districts. Oftentimes when they get into their districts, they're meeting with their high-roller contributors, and other times when they're on recess, they're taking junkets to Caribbean islands and places of that sort. How much of an effect does it have to get this real picture of the long-term unemployment of people who are having trouble putting food on the table for their children, people who are getting cuts in health care and VA benefits and things of that sort? How much of that gets through to them? And I'd like you to just encourage listeners to send that kind of information in the Congress.
Absolutely. I can say that a lot of people think that writing letters to their Congress members and calling into their Congress members does not make a difference, or they don't get it, or they don't hear. One of the things that when we went into these offices, in one office in particular, a couple of offices, they were sitting there listening on a loudspeaker to the people who were calling in, expressing their concerns for certain issues, bills going on, writing notes on it. What did that person just say? They're listening to these things. And the more pressure we put on them, the more we present this fight from a personal level, what is happening to you? We had a lady, I went to a meeting with Bill. There was a lady who had to take a pay cut from working for several years with the auto industry, had to accept the buyout. And after accepting the buyout, she is going to lose her pension because of what's going on in the Michigan-Detroit situation. People know, look, this is a murderous policy, and we have to let the population know that, have to let the Congress know, and each and every one of the listeners has to let the Congress know that we're not going to sit back and allow for them to kill the American people off in order to defend and keep a banking financial oligarchy and speculators going. And so a lot of these personal letters have a real effect as we're taking them in, and we would sit there and read some of these letters to the staffers that we're meeting with. What do you think about this? What do you think about the fact that your constituent is losing their job, having to take pay cuts, having to lose their pensions? Do you know what's going to happen if this continues? You're going to have all hell unleashed in the nation. So this is very important, and it's important that people really express to these Congress members that we're not going to sit back and watch this happen.
And Dave, one of the things Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing, and he brought it up again last night in the webcast, is that there's a detachment from reality that's in Washington, D.C., that they're not clear on this. Did you get a sense of that?
Well, exactly, and I think what Keisha was just going through is, and the need for the American people to actually say the truth about what's going on, because, you know, there's sort of famous anecdotes of this, but people will always want to say that things are better than they actually are. I don't know if it's a quality of optimism or, you know, in some people's cases, I'm sure it's a little bit of delusion, but, you know, the famous cases of people, even during the Depression, who would put their suits on, stand outside of a cafe with a toothpick just to give the impression that they actually ate something, you know. That kind of idea is pervasive, as an idea that it's not as bad as we think. Now, we have to be clear that it is as bad as we think. I mean, the idea that the economy is in a recovery while one in seven Americans is on food stamps, while the drought has destroyed crops, what is left of the crops, we have 40% of that going into the gas tank with this ethanol policy, which is that's about as simple as it gets to describing this as a genocide policy, to literally take food and burn it. And the other factor is that this isn't just in the United States. This is international, and LaRouche has constantly stressed that people also need to see this is what's going on in Europe. You know, for the first time, the birth rate is lower than the death rate. There's only 1.3 children being born per mother in Italy. The stillbirths in Greece has increased by 10, or I believe it might be as high as 20%.
21%
in Greece.
Yeah.
This is the policy dictated by the international banking cartel, by the old British East India Company complex, what we've identified as the Anglo-Dutch Empire, and that is the reality. And so I think the point to the listeners, and to get the listeners as well to get their friends and families to call in and give a sense of how dire this actually is, because that's one of the ways that, you know, we go back to these lines or talking points or really lies is what we should call them, which dominate people's sense of what's going on. And it's not the truth. The truth is the American people are being destroyed, and we need to launch an all-out assault on this, you know, international banking, oligarchy. And Glass-Steagall is the way to do it. And, you know, I just would say this, one of the things that we've emphasized and we're going to continue to expand is the idea of a PCORA commission. Now, whether that means we actually get a hearings going and all that is not as relevant as creating the conditions that we know who the enemy is, we're going to smoke these guys out in terms of this revolving door concept. I mean, you know, Keisha and I had a meeting, and one of the staffers was with a top international bank. He had just come from there for a major metropolitan area, the director of policy for a major metropolitan area. I mean, it's that direct that you have people, coming into the Congress to run the show to ensure that nothing goes through like Glass-Steagall. And so so we're going to be exposing the names. We're going to be exposing how much money people are getting, and say, why aren't you signing on to Glass-Steagall? You're on the banking committee, and you say you have no position on this. Well, we know why you don't, and we know why you're against it. We know why, because you're taking the money from J.P. Morgan. You're taking the money from Goldman Sachs. You're taking the money from Wall Street. So that's going to be very crucial to create the conditions that the better ones who do want to fight, and we have a network of congressmen and senators that do know of the crisis right now and are willing to fight, but they need us to be leading the charge.
And at the same time that we're going to be telling them that we know why they're on the other side because of where their money's coming from, we're going to get that out to their constituents and say, did you know that your congressman is in the pocket of J.P. Morgan Chase? Now, the other question that was posed last night by Lyndon LaRouche, which was a little bit different in terms of his emphasis, although he had brought this up before, is that he made the point that the fight over Glass-Steagall is not just about a banking policy or even just about physical economy, but that if the banks can stop Glass-Steagall, they're going to go ahead and cancel their debts in any case because they know they can't pay them. This is, in fact, what the BIS report was saying. But they're going to cancel the debts primarily that are tied up in providing health care, providing pensions, and we see this now in Detroit. So I'm wondering to what extent, I assume, Keisha, this is something we're going to take out this week to the Congress, that this added element that if they defeat Glass-Steagall, they're going to launch murderous policies against the constituencies.
Yes, we're going to be taking that out into the Congress, and also people can
get ready to receive a report from Bill Roberts, who was the candidate, the Rouge PAC Policy Committee candidate in Detroit, in the Michigan area, who ran for Congress. And one thing, like Bill said, and this is going to come out in his interviews and discussions, is people might remember from our LaRouche PAC website, if you're on the LaRouche PAC website, not even a year ago, Bill warned people in Detroit, as he testified in the Detroit City Council, that if Glass-Steagall was not passed, if they didn't move to get Glass-Steagall, then they were going to face massive austerity and that they were going to see a collapse in the banking industries come in and totally overhaul Detroit. And everything that he was warning, and everything that LaRouche warned, came to pass, because that's what's happening right now. Detroit is just an example in the United States of what this banking interest has prepared and is ready to unleash. You're talking about mass genocide. You're talking about murder of the population. As Mr. LaRouche said last night, you're going to have people sitting out on the street, starving to death. And that's why people have to take this fight seriously. So we're going to be putting out more reports on that. I think Bill's going to be doing some interviews later. And we're going to be taking that straight to the Congress. Is this your intention? But I think the other thing is, the Congress members, they think, you know, especially staffers too, they think that they're safe. They think that, oh, well, that's happening out there. That's happening outside the Beltway. Or, you know, they're acting as though they're oblivious, and they might be oblivious to what's really going on in their states, in their district. But the reality is that Wall Street doesn't care about them either. They will kill them too. And we are very clear on that, if you try to capitulate to this banking interest, don't think that they're going to be your friend and they're going to protect you. They'll leave you hanging just the same. And so that's why we have to destroy this banking interest. And as you said, what just happened with the Detroit situation, and, you know, the loss of pensions and filling of the safety nets of the population, that's going to be unleashed throughout the country if we don't win this fight. And that's why winning the fight is even bigger than Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall is what that represents, as the first step to destroying the enemy, destroying the Wall Street banking interest.
Let me just say something about the Detroit
situation. Actually, Harley, could I just jump in real quick?
Go ahead.
I just think that point of Detroit, now keep in mind there are a few other cities actually in Michigan itself, Benton Harbor, I believe Pontiac,
right,
also have these financial managers, you know, the city under distress, and we're just going to bring in the banker's dictatorship to run your city. And there was a case that I found somewhat, maybe not the most important in terms of what actually happened, but if you think of the implications of it, it is very stunning, which is Bill was reporting that, I believe it was just outside of Detroit, and or it was in Detroit, and one of the school boards had a vacant position. And so the other parts of the school board were going to vote and have a vote to figure out how to fill that seat. And the emergency manager stepped in and simply appointed somebody to the school board position, which would just stunned the people, the other members of the school board, saying, well, wait a second, this is democracy, is you elect somebody. You don't just have the financial dictator of the city appoint somebody. And so I think, you know, that's the other side of this is, yes, there's the murderous austerity, but look, this is about as straight fascist as you can get, where the, you know, actual means of having democratic elections and so forth to decide the future of this nation, you know, the future of a nation or the future of a people, and that is simply being cut out. And so I think for these congressmen, you know, they say, oh, well, this is just, you know, these are just city councilors. This is just around at the lower level. Well, how long do you think it's going to be before the same policy is being applied at the federal level? And in fact, you know, I think we could already realize that the implication in terms of, you know, how Wall Street is directly controlling and influencing policy now, it's already happening.
It's already happening, right.
Yeah, let me just review a couple of the points on this Detroit bankruptcy, because as you pointed out, Bill Roberts, during his campaign for the Democratic nomination for Congress in a district adjoining Detroit, brought this up, the fact that the city of Detroit was paying large amounts of money for financial management, for credit default swaps, so-called risk management of its debt. And Bill brought this up, and this was a part of his campaign where he got 41% of the vote in the Democratic primary. But here's what they just decided to do. They prioritize payments to the banks. So when they declare a bankruptcy in Detroit, the idea of bankruptcy is you protect the entity so that it can be reorganized to continue to function. Well, what they did in doing this is, instead of protecting the city, which is the people in the city and the institutions of the city, the only thing they're protecting is the debt owed to banks that were looting the city through bond offerings, through risk management, and so on. So that gets priority, 80 cents on the dollar, whereas pensions are going to be paid back about 10 cents on the dollar. You mentioned the school system. The schools are going to have 35, 40, 45 students per classroom in Detroit because of the cutbacks in money for education. The police department has been cut dramatically, and Detroit is seeing the highest murder rate and highest crime rate that it's had since before World War II. The population of Detroit is now about 42% of what it was 20 years ago. Now, all of this is happening as President Barack Obama claims that he saved Detroit with the so-called auto bailout. So if this is Obama's example of saving a city, then we'd better not let him save anything else, because there won't be anyone left to survive. So I think this Detroit issue is something that we can use. And again, it's not just Detroit. There are a number of other cities and counties facing the same thing. Now, I want to then pick up on this and have both of you speak on this question of the particular role of J.P. Morgan Chase and the Bush family in organizing this post-industrial deregulatory collapse, because Morgan has been directly involved in the policy on the other side of setting up the looting. And now Morgan, in their own name, is trying to stop Glass-Steagall. So, you know, I'd like to hear from both of you on this question. Dave, you mentioned the PCORA Commission. Why don't we start with you? Obviously, J.P. Morgan Chase is one of the first culprits that should be brought up before a PCORA Commission.
Yes, exactly. I also think, just in discussions that we had the other night, Ms. Helga Zepp-LaRouche made the point that, yes, J.P. Morgan is one of the key scoundrels, but what we're really dealing with is the British Empire, this Anglo-Dutch banking oligarchy and so forth. And so, you know, to the degree that we're looking at this, we really have to see it as this integrated imperial structure around the nation. But I think, just, you know, the case of J.P. Morgan is striking, because they, in the case of Delaware, where we now have, I believe it's up to 24 state legislatures. We have a few other states with promises to make good on also putting forward memorials, which would tip the scale of having over half the states in the country with memorials calling for Glass-Steagall. And now keep in mind that these memorials are simply calling on the Congress to act.
Yeah, they're not binding bills or anything.
Exactly.
They're just
an expression of
concern.
Exactly. And so for the case of Delaware, they actually have to, any lobbyist has to register with the state, and that's public available information, and to discuss what bill that they're coming in to lobby around. Now, in the case of the Delaware Memorial for Glass-Steagall, You had, I believe, five bank lobbyists, a number of them J.P. Morgan, I think Bank of America had somebody in there, all coming in to pressure the Delaware state legislature to not pass the Glass-Steagall Memorial, and literally testifying, telling them that Delaware, this is going to be bad for Delaware and so on and so forth. Well, why? Let me ask this. How many millions of dollars could have these guys been making that day, you know, in their looting and pillaging operation, and they're going to take time out of their day to come in and pressure the Delaware state legislature to not pass a memorial that has no legal binding, right? So that's an indication that these guys know what the real, where we're at in this fight, and that the mobilization that we've done around the nation, that this will bring them down, and they know it.
And Keisha, on this point, something that I think I may have mentioned to you, I met with a leading banker the other day who told me that when we had our lobbyists, our organizers, in Austin, Texas, trying to get a bill, a similar memorial resolution through the Texas legislature, that in the midst of that period, J.P. Morgan Chase had a conference of investors in Austin, Texas, and Jamie Dimon personally attended it. And while he was there, he went to meet with Governor Rick Perry and told the governor the same kind of thing they told them in Delaware. J.P. Morgan Chase accounts for 30,000 jobs in Texas. Governor, it could be more than that as long as you keep a banking-friendly environment in Texas. And again, that's the kind of bare knuckles threat, this time from the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Also, Marianne Lake, who's the CFO of J.P. Morgan Chase, was someone who was trotted out to counter the Glass-Steagall bill in most of the media. So, Keisha, I thought you might have some comments on the fact that, well, you were in Austin with a team of activists pushing for this memorial. J.P. Morgan Chase had its CEO and the poster boy of deregulation, Jamie Dimon, in the state capitol countering what we were doing.
Yeah, it's not surprising because, I mean, what we have seen here is that the J.P. Morgan interests are, you know, first of all, remember, Texas, that's Phil Graham, the person who personally took down with the Graham-Leach-Lively Act the Glass-Steagall bill, who repealed Glass-Steagall. And in Texas at that same time, not only did you have J.P. Morgan or have Jamie Dimon, should I say, as you're saying, but Obama was even there. And this was around that same time. I wasn't aware until recently, as you're saying, that the Jamie Dimon interests were there. But that just goes to show how desperate these guys are and how the enemy is working. You know, they're out to intimidate, they're out to kill, they're out to do everything that they have to keep their banking interests safe. And this is why, look, as Mr. Lewis said last night, these guys can't win. Their system is finished already. They're bankrupt. They know it. Why are they having to go around to these states and try to stop non-binding resolutions, stop memorials from being passed? Because they know what this really represents, that they're finished. They will be bankrupted. We will not pay their gambling debt, and they can't have that. And so Texas, of course, would be a target. Like some of these other states, as the Delaware situation, J.P. Morgan said, look, we employ, 40% or something, I can't remember the exact...
26,000.
26,000?
26,000 jobs in Delaware, yeah.
In Delaware, and, you know, Texas, the same thing. I mean, this goes back to, you know, the interest of the Wall Street interests, the oil and gas, everything. So I think the most important thing, though, is how the desperation of these guys and how it is that we can defeat that.
Let me take this up because this is the other thing we run into in the Congress and in the field when we organize. People just say, and it came up, I did a meeting in Dallas the other night, and, and one person who was the most vehement in saying we have to bring down the bankers, at the same time was saying, but you can't do it.
Right.
And this idea, I'd like you to address that, because this is where you see the pragmatism and the stupidity of the American people, the submission, let's say, to this aura of power of the bankers. How do you address that?
Well, I think Mr. LaRouche addressed it last night, that if we're going to survive, if we're going to actually regain our power, our constitutional power of who we are as creative human beings, as a nation of, by, for the people, as a republic, then we have to put aside our fears, and we have to break the cowardice, because the biggest threat, the biggest enemy or in opposition to us winning this fight, getting the job done on Glass-Steagall and actually implementing the policy solutions that are necessary, is really not the, you know, the banking interest or, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, but it's our own sense of it, you know, sense of cowardice that grips the population, or the sense that we can't do anything. They're bigger than us. They're more powerful than us. They will never let it happen. And, you know, that's the line that you hear in the Congress, and that's the line that you hear in the population, because people have lost a sense of their moral authority, of, you know, their unique difference as representing a human species, that, you know, we're more powerful than any animal or anything out there, and that we can defeat this oligarchy, because that's the intention, to keep human beings enslaved and to keep them thinking that they're no more than cattle, and they have to go along with the policy of population reduction, and that they have no power. And that is not what the nature of human beings really is. And this is why, look, what we're going to do with this J.P. Morgan, with this banking interest, as Dave said, is we're going to expose these guys. We're going to get this PCORA Commission going now, because we can't have it where the banking lobbyist, J.P. Morgan, these guys get away with slaps on the wrist and being continued to be bailed out. As Ben Bernanke said at a hearing when we were the Fed chair, in Washington, D.C., oh, don't worry about the banks coming to you for more bailouts, because that's already being taken care of. We have quantitative easing, and that's not going to be stopped. We're going to have more quantitative easing. We're going to have more money printing. And on top of that, we have the Dodd-Frank Act with Title II. So we're just going to start stealing deposits. So if that's the intention, and we know that's the intention, then we cannot allow our fears and our cowardice to stop us from doing everything possible to destroy these guys.
And Dave, on that point, obviously what the LaRouche Policy Committee itself has gone through is somewhat of a change in the last couple of days, through the discussions with Lynn coming back every night and talking about these encounters with Congress. The fact that Lynn said, look, you've got to be totally straightforward and truthful with these guys, look them in the eye and say, look, you're going to kill us. You're going to kill yourself if you do this. And I think that's, in fact, part of the message we have to get out to our listeners. Why hold back? Everyone knows that the country's going in the wrong direction. They don't know the details. We can provide that. But the real issue is for them to find the courage of human beings who want to ensure a future for their children and grandchildren. And I'd like you to just talk about that a little bit, because one of the important points that we're providing with this program is not details on our lobbying efforts, but giving people a sense of what they can bring to the fight that will move people. And that's really the issue. We've got to inspire a fighting attitude in the American people. So, Dave, yes, if you could talk about that for a minute.
Well, I think what LaRouche did, Mr. LaRouche did last night in his webcast, I think the final answer that he gave went to the heart of that. And, you know, in some ways what he said is, you know, the American people are very beat down, demoralized, and so forth. But actually, I'm somewhat reminded that LaRouche's answer to that was reminiscent of what Churchill, I believe, said when he said, After everything else fails, the American will always do what's right. So, you know, that idea that the American soul is against empire, is against fascism, and will come out to fight, but only if it has leadership. And that leadership which has the courage to say who the enemy is and has the moral policy to fight against that. Because I think that's the other thing. It's, yes, we need to know what we're talking about, but oftentimes what you find is people who have a certain amount of intellectual fears or are soft on things, it's when they get the moral fight in them, then they develop the certain intellectual capabilities to put forward the policy and so forth. So in other words, it's oftentimes that quality of, I am going to fight for humanity, and now I'll figure out what I need to do. It's not the other way around. It's not a certain intellectual capability that comes before the moral capability. And so I think that idea that we can awaken the sleeping giant, you know, we can awaken this Pearl Harbor-like moment where up until Pearl Harbor, many Americans were asleep, and after Pearl Harbor, everybody's signing up to destroy fascism, signing up to go, join the military and so forth. So I think that quality, we can awaken that, but it will only be done with leadership. And so everybody on listening to this program should be mobilizing your network and awaken that better part of the American within in them, which, it will actually fight for a human policy, fight for the future of mankind, because that's really what Glass-Steagall is. It's not just simply banking reform. The credit policy isn't just simply a new kind of banking. It's a commitment to the future. It's that the credit that we issue forward is going to build up the nation, create a better future for mankind, and that's what pays back the debt we're taking on now. It's really more of a moral statement than anything.
And this was the topic of the most recent paper from Lyndon LaRouche on this question of how the oligarchical principle is at the heart of what is evil. And you hear a lot of people talking in politics about morality. Much of it is around these social issues, these hot button issues, but very rarely do they get to this question of the nature of the human being. And I know, Keisha, when you campaign, this is an important thing that you keep coming back to, and that does resonate with people, this question of what are you as a human being? What is your real responsibility? And to the extent that some of these congressmen have some shred of humanity left in them, I assume that's what we've got to reach in this next week or two.
That's absolutely right, and that's what we're out to really really push in this next week, because we have to change the hearts, souls, and minds of these Congress members, the population, and we have to get them to start standing up and acting as human beings again and not as subjects to an empire or as puppets to Wall Street. And I think that the most important thing that we can communicate is a show of force from the population. Once again, I think it's important that the listeners, that the population has a sense that this is their fight, that we have to think like George Washington. And this is what we were telling a lot of these, a lot of the representatives or the staffers that we were meeting with in the Congress. Now's the time to think like George Washington, to think like Alexander Hamilton. What would Alexander Hamilton do in this situation? How would Alexander Hamilton take on the banking interest to take on the enemy? And it is really, as Dave said, to reiterate, is having a commitment to the future of mankind, having a commitment to not just the children and grandchildren, but several generations from now. And people have to see themselves as on the stage of history. As Helga Zepp-LaRouche said in a conference we just had, if Shakespeare or Schiller could be here today, I mean, what they would write and what they would actually put forth in exposing or really looking at the drama that we're on the stage of history right now. And what we're doing is the policy committee is acting as chorus and saying, what will you do? How will you respond to the call? And look, get out there, call your Congress members, do everything in your power to win this fight, because this might be our last chance to do it. And don't say, I don't have time to do it now, so maybe I'll do it next time. Drop everything that you're doing and make the commitment to act on this fight now. And that's what I would say to the population is, you know, winning this means that what we can create is a new direction for mankind, unlike anything we've ever seen before.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think, you know, there's a way where we're not going to get Glass-Steagall through because we've mastered the parliamentary tricks to get it done. And because this is one of the things that comes up. You say, look, we're going to do this in the next 2 weeks. And congressmen, staff, wait a second. We have all these other bills. We have this we have to worry about. And instead say, no, what we're going to do is we're going to change the whole conception of where we're at in history right now, that the collapse is coming on. This is echoed by numerous economists. I think Tom Honig has probably been the clearest on this, that the crash is coming soon. It is not going to be one or two banks. It is systemic, and they will come screaming. Wall Street will come screaming to the Congress, we need the bailout. We need the bail-in policy under Dodd-Frank. Bernanke actually said this in this testimony, saying that in the event of the next crash, we have Title II, which is just going to steal the deposits of our citizens. So, the urgency and the sense that we can get this done now, and we're going to do it. And to create that attitude on the Hill, that's what we are doing in the next couple of weeks, is to get that as an idea in the minds of the Congress about the nature of the crisis, what Glass-Steagall will do to wipe out this international banking oligarchy and set us on the path to recovery. And if we can get that as an idea, a gestalt in the minds of the Congress, they know how to move bills forward. You know, they passed that bailout within 24 hours. They had a vote against it, and then 24 hours later, they were back on it again. And Paulson and company were threatening martial law, and they passed it. So
they know how to press
yeah,
yes or no buttons.
Exactly.
But the question is the fight behind it. So Keisha, we just have a couple minutes left. What are the marching orders for our listeners for the next days?
Well, the marching orders are simple. Call your Congress member. Tell them, get Glass-Steagall through now. It's the first order of business. Write letters. Come to Washington, D.C. if you can. We've extended our stay here. The policy committee is going to stay here and get the job done. So we'll be here for another week, maybe 2 weeks. And we just need you to do everything in your power to join in and to help us win this fight.
I would say don't just talk to your congressman, talk to your neighbors, your coworkers,
yes, yes,
people at church, your next-door neighbor, even talk to your husband or wife, and let's get a full mobilization. And I would add that should include contributing to LaRouche PAC, because to keep our team up there for an extra week, there's travel costs, there's all sorts of other things. We need the backup across the board. And if you can't get into Washington, D.C., well, contribute the money that you would have to pay for a flight to LaRouche PAC so that we can carry out this fight. But in the meantime, people should do everything they can to make sure this battle is won. And I would add, go to LaRouchePAC.com and watch the webcast that Lyndon LaRouche did last night, which will give you a real in-depth sense of what this fight is about, and also the courage of LaRouche, and also his optimism that you, as our citizens, can take up this fight. So, Dave and Keisha, thank you very much. I know you're in the midst of an exhausting schedule up there. Thanks for taking the time to join us on the program today.
Thanks, Harley.
You.
And we will be back next Saturday, as always, with another issue, another edition, I should say, of the LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Eastern at larouchepub.com. Thanks for joining us today, and don't let this week pass by without you becoming a full-fledged American citizen. Goodbye.